This morning's sermon will be in three parts. At each beginning of the new part, I will read from the book of Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. So I'll be speaking the words of Malcolm Gladwell. Afterwards, Reverend Lucy will be reading the words of Reverend Lucy. The first segment is titled Thin Slicing. When you walk out into the street and suddenly realize that a truck is bearing down on you, do you have time to think through all your options? Of course not. The only way that human beings could ever have survived as a species for as long as we have is that we've developed another kind of decision-making, apparatus that's capable of making very quick judgments based on very little information. That part of our brain that leaps to conclusions is called adaptive unconscious. And it's not to be confused with that dark, murky unconscious described by Sigmund Freud. Adaptive unconsciousness is thought of instead as a kind of gigantic computer that quickly and quietly processes a lot of data we need in order to keep functioning as human beings. Thin slicing refers to the ability of our unconscious to find the patterns in situations and behaviors based on a very narrow slice of experience. Thin slicing is not an exotic gift. It is a central part of what it means to be human. We thin slice whenever we meet a new person or have to make sense of something quickly or encounter a novel situation. We thin slice because we have to. And we come to rely on that ability because there are lots of hidden fists out there, lots of situations where careful attention to the details of a very thin slice, even for no more than a second or two, can tell us an awful lot. I think we are innately suspicious of this kind of rapid cognition. We live in a world that assumes that the quality of a decision is directly related to the time and effort that went into making it. However, decisions made very quickly can be every bit as good as decisions made cautiously and deliberately.
We have a lot of TV channels in our house. I don't know, 10,000, 800, I don't know. But it's typical for my spouse to be sitting in her easy chair going through the channels. Click, 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 click. And it goes by so fast. So I said to her, how do you know what you want to watch and what you don't want to watch? So she gave me a demonstration. Stupid, boring, scary, creepy, football, boring, stupid. She's thin slicing. She's taking what's presented to her in the most 2 seconds, which seems like less than a second to me, but it could be 3 seconds per channel. She's processing it through her own filter and making a split decision about whether there's something on that channel that she wants to watch. Apparently it works because she does find things eventually. Another example of thin slicing is what bird watchers do. Some of you may very well be bird watchers or have a bird watcher in your life. Bird watchers often, especially the ones that are experienced, they just know it. They just know the bird. And sometimes they don't necessarily, they could tell you by the turn of a wing or the movement of the beak, or they just know it. And it's based on their knowledge and their study of birds, but some quality that they have that's able to just, in a blink, discern what kind of bird that is that just flew by, where you probably didn't even see the bird if you're not an expert bird watcher. But we don't have to be experts to thin slice things in our lives. We do it all the time. You walk into a room and you know something is wrong. Immediately, you couldn't necessarily say specifically what it was, but you know that something is wrong. You don't have to go around and take an inventory of things with a clipboard to immediately take in the experience of wrongness. We do thin slicing a lot, of course, with people, because this is where our primary interaction. Job interviews are a very typical place where we do thin slicing. Oftentimes, I know from experience of hiring more than 100 people in my administrative career, that I knew, not quite instantly, but almost, whether this was somebody that I could envision working in my office. I definitely knew by the first question. And I couldn't necessarily tell you why. I needed the rest of the information to balance out my instincts in that process. There was a study done of professors, and they showed students a 10-second clip of professors with no sound on, and they could tell you within 10 seconds whether that was a good professor or not in terms of imparting the information. In fact, they cut it down to 5 seconds, and they could tell. They cut it down to 2 seconds, and students could say yes or no whether that was a good professor. And the results corroborated with the evaluations that the students did at the end of the class. My favorite of the thin slicing is speed dating. Now, back in the days when I was dating, you actually sat down with somebody and maybe had a meal with them, even if you'd met them online or you'd meet them in a coffee house or you'd spend time with them. But any of you who've sat through an unbearable first date trying to figure out how you could make an excuse to get out of there and not be rude knows that you can know right away whether this person is somebody that you could potentially see yourself with. In speed dating, the women sit on one row and the men move. They spend 6 minutes with each partner and they move from person to person. The people that lead the speed dating will tell you that they can pinpoint almost instantly the couples that have connected and the couples that haven't. What they found in speed dating is that what people fill out on the form about what they say they really want, what their rational mind says they really want, often doesn't match to the person that they have this instant connection and attraction to. That instinctive, unconscious connection overrides whatever their rational list was. This, of course, is where we get love at first sight. Some couples with love at first sight are married forever. Others end, probably the same percentage as couples who've known each other. The same with couples that are arranged marriages. They let the couple meet each other, and they can veto it if they choose. But those arranged marriages, if they look at that person and say, I think I can make a go of it with you, those arranged marriages have just as good a chance as marriages of people that spend years getting to know each other. This is our gut that we're talking about. Those of you who heard my sermon in May about embodiment and the body, I talked about when you have a gut feeling that you can't rationally explain, but you just know. You know something is right or you know something is wrong. The main story in the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell is about a kairos, a sculpture of a young male that was sold to the Getty Museum as a 2,000-year-old sculpture. All the data showed that it was truly what they said it was, and all the art experts said it could not be that. The art experts said when they looked at it, they felt a little sick to their stomach. They got clammy. One of them got dizzy. And it ultimately proved that the data was redone and proved that the kairos was a fake. So clearly, we can make accurate assessments at a glance.
That sometimes we can know more about someone or something in the blink of an eye than we can after months of study. But we also have to acknowledge and understand those circumstances when rapid cognition lead us astray. In the past few years, a number of psychologists have begun to look more closely at the role adaptive unconsciousness plays in our beliefs and our associations. Much of their work has focused on the very fascinating tool called the Implicit Association Test, or the IAT. Implicit Association Test. The most famous of these tests is the Race IAT. At the beginning of the test, you are asked your attitudes towards blacks and towards whites. Black faces are assigned to the left-hand side, and white faces are on the right side. Then a series of words and images appear, and you have to assign them to either the black side or the white side. Bad, glorious, wonderful, evil, pictures of a gun, a flower, etc. The system measures how long it takes you to make a selection, and then mixes things up and tests again. Malcolm was rated having a moderate preference for whites, but then again, he's half black. It turns out that more than 80% of those who have ever taken the test end up having pro-white associations. So what does this mean? Does this mean Malcolm is a racist, self-hating black person? Not exactly. What it means is that our attitudes towards things like race or gender operate on two levels. First of all, we have our conscious attitudes. This is what we choose to believe. These are our stated values, which we use to direct our behaviors deliberately. But the IAT measures something else. It measures our second level of attitude, our racial attitude on an unconscious level, the immediate automatic associations that tumble out before we've even had time to think. We don't deliberately choose our unconscious attitudes. The giant computer that is our unconscious silently crunches all of the data it can from the experiences we've had, the people we've met, the lessons we've learned, the books we've read, etc. The disturbing thing about the test is that it shows that our unconscious attitudes may be utterly incompatible with our stated conscious values.
When I was reading this section of the book, a song from South Pacific, those of you who are music theater fans will know the song, You Have to Be Carefully Taught. It's singing about how people are taught to be racist or biased in certain ways, and it talks about it has to be drummed into your dear little ear. And I thought of that song and then realized that the type of bias that we're talking about now is not the conscious bias of living with racist parents or being in a culture where it's overtly discriminatory and drummed into your head. We're talking about the type of bias that is in the air, is in our culture, is in our TV and all the ways that we interact in the world. And we can't, because they're unconscious for us, we can't really override these biases, even if we're well-intentioned, non-consciously racist or homophobic or whatever discrimination we're talking about. We can't override these biases, and they come out in various tiny little ways that people in the communities that discuss this call microaggressions. Little acknowledgments of our unconscious discomfort with various people that are different from us. My Facebook feed right now has a lot of discussion about racism, institutionalized racism. It's a word that is we're carrying around right now as we're challenged with what's going on in our world and the uplifting of all the issues of treatment of people of color in this country. And we spend a lot of time trying to determine and debating whether some behavior or something is racist or not. And I think we're missing an important part of the conversation because there's little discussion about unconscious bias. It makes it hard for the majority of us, including people of color who carry these biases, to have a conversation about unconscious bias. And it's hard for us to feel comfortable discussing these things with each other. We had a book discussion group on Wednesday night around the book Blank, and we had a really, really thoughtful discussion about these issues and addressed our own awareness of our internalized biases, our unconscious biases. How could we not be biased living in North America with all the cultural messages that link white with good? In the book Blink, Malcolm Gladwell gives a couple of really good examples that talk about this unconscious bias. Of course, you probably heard the one about the resumes going out that have the same exact qualifications, but one is named David and one's named Dante. And the Davids get called back and the Dantes don't. Now, were the people in those organizations overtly racist? Maybe, but maybe they weren't. The story that Gladwell tells is about a car sales experience where this researcher sent out a group of white men, a group of white women, black women, and black men out to buy a car. And they all dressed, the women dressed exactly alike, the men dressed exactly alike. And they were assigned the task of bargaining to the best price. So the white men got the best price without doing very much at all. The white women got the next best price with some effort. The black women got the third best price with a medium amount of effort, and the black men were $1,000 below the white men. There was no possibility. None of them had the experience of being able to bargain the same price that the white men did. The same question, are those racist car dealerships? I could see my Facebook post saying that, right? I believe this is unconscious bias that we're dealing with here. 50% of the African Americans who take the IAT show more positive associations with white than they do with black. This is what we call internalized racism. This is known in the gay and lesbian community as well as internalized homophobia. You absorb what the culture is telling you, and you internalize it in a way that you have negative associations with what you are, with an identity that you have. This is not just about race or sexual orientation. We have unconscious bias around gender. We have unconscious bias around age, with a preference for young versus old. Our language is dotted with those types of associations. We have internalized bias against fat people. You don't have to look very far to see those things coming up. We develop these data in that computer. These biases are developed in that computer that is churning all that we're exposed to all through our lives. And it's important for us to acknowledge these biases so that we can all move forward in a positive way.
More from Gladwell's book, Blink. Our first impressions are generated by our experiences and our environment, which means that we can change our first impressions. We can alter the way we thin slice by changing the experiences that comprise those impressions. If before you take the race AIT, you were to look over a series of pictures or articles about people like Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela, your reaction time would change. Suddenly, it won't seem so hard to associate positive things with black people. If you are a white person who would like to treat black people as equals in every way, who would like to have a set of associations with blacks that are as positive as those you have with whites, it requires more than a simple commitment to equality. It requires that you change your life so that you are exposed to minorities on a regular basis and become comfortable with them and familiar with the best of their culture, so that when you meet, hire, date, or talk with a member of a minority, you aren't betrayed by your hesitation and discomfort. Taking rapid cognition seriously, acknowledging the incredible power, for good and ill, that impression plays in our lives, requires that we take active steps to manage and control those impressions.
So where do we go from here? You can take the AIT. You can go online at Harvard. Just put into Google IAT Harvard, and you can take the 10 different versions of that test, or you can sign up to be a participant where they engage you in a variety of tests. I went online last night and did this, and it was quite interesting. I took a variety of tests, and it will really get you thinking. I encourage all of you that have computers and internet access to take that up. I think the first step that we need to do is to acknowledge our unconscious biases. Race, gender, age, weight. You can pick your other. You can pick your ism that is about people that are different from you. We're all products of these messages that we get in our environment. But if we pay attention to what comes up for us when we're with someone that is different from us, where we're exposed to something that challenges us, pay attention to what associations come up for you. Don't flinch. Don't judge yourself. When we become more aware of our unconscious biases, it can be a painful recognition of how we've been influenced and how we're contributing. But don't flinch from that. Be honest with yourself, be loving with yourself about how we all carry these unconscious biases. Just notice them and internally question what's going on for you with that. Where do you think that comes from? What kind of feelings am I having? What kind of thoughts am I having? The recent transgendered presentation of Caitlyn Jenner is providing the whole world with an opportunity to engage with unconscious bias around gender. Now, of course, Caitlyn presents in a very, very feminine way. There was no process that occurred that we were exposed to in his transition or her transition from male to female. But our culture is on the cutting edge now. So be aware of what comes up for you as these transgender issues are presented. Be aware of how you feel and just pay attention. We're all seeing the Black Lives Matter statements now, an amazing and appropriate response to what is going on, something that is long, long time coming in our culture. And I've heard people say, well, of course Black Lives Matter, all lives matter. This is out there on Facebook, bam, 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 all lives matter. The idea of Black Lives Matter is to lift up this awareness of the worthiness of Black lives in the face of all this cultural bias. Whether it's institutionalized racism or whether it's our own unconscious bias, this is present in our culture, and saying Black Lives Matter lifts it up. It raises awareness. Many of the people that were at our discussion group on Wednesday night were feeling this hopefulness about young people who are coming up in a world that is not so overtly racist or homophobic. They were hopeful of this possibility of a future where our culture does not imprint on us these ideas of who's bad and who's good, who's worthy and who's unworthy. But it's not just for us leaving it to the young people. I think we all have a task of understanding ourselves and paying attention to what's going on for us around these issues. There's another car sales story in the book Blink that represents how to be in this world in a way of managing your unconscious biases, where Gladwell goes and interviews one of the best car salesmen in the country. And his story is that he treats every single person who comes into his dealership with the same possibility that they're going to buy a car. Now, of course, he thin slices. He's a salesman, right? He gauges them. He checks them out. But he's aware that he has unconscious biases that may influence him, and he treats them all exactly the same. And he sells more cars than anyone else. A young person comes in, he doesn't assume they can't afford it. A person maybe in disheveled clothing, he doesn't assume that they're not there to buy a car. He treats everyone as if they have the same ability to buy a car. Years ago, I worked in public health nutrition, and one of my responsibilities was to send a team of survey people out to grocery stores to interview people about things that they'd seen in the grocery store. We were doing some nutritional promotions. And I learned really quickly that my instructions to them would be, ask every single person, not just the pretty people. not just the people that you're comfortable asking. Ask every single person, or else we're going to introduce statistical bias in our sample. I was very careful to sample the grocery stores in the state of California, but the unconscious bias of the survey takers were make it so that they weren't feeling comfortable asking the survey questions of certain people. Primarily, they like to ask survey questions to the people who looked just like them. We are gifted, truly gifted, with these two ways of processing information. Our rational minds that goes over data, does calculations, analyzes discussions, evaluates, and then this unconscious way of thin slicing and knowing, just knowing whether something is right or wrong. This is our toolkit for life, for living in this complex world. I want to lift up that autistic people don't have that thin slicing toolkit. They're missing a portion of that. This is something that Gladwell also talks in the book. So when you're, if you want to raise your awareness of what it's like to be autistic, think about what it would be like to walk into a room and not have the ability to assess the energy of the room, or meet with somebody and not have the ability to take their, get a take on them, because you don't have that ability to process. We have our conscious, rational thought that we can use to direct our behavior deliberately. Then we have this unconscious, this immediate, automatic associations that tumble out before we even have a chance to think about them. We have these unconscious biases that affect the way we interact with people, the way we make choices, the way we live our lives. Gladwell concludes that one of the greatest challenges of our time is learning how to combine the best of conscious deliberation and instinctive judgment. And I say that in this age of information overload, we need to keep both our hearts and our minds open, to be flexible to how we're influenced by the world and how we influence the world. May it be so.